This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master, from the Book of Serenity. Case 57, Yan Yang's thing, the pointer. Playing with reflections, struggling for the forms, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. Raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know that the voice is the root of the echo. If it's not riding an ox, looking for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid these extremes? The main case. Venerable Yan Yang asked Zhao Zhou, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Yan Yang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhao Zhou said, then carry it out. The verse. Not prepared for meticulous action, he loses to the first to move. Realizing himself the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. When the game is ended, the axe handles rotted at his side. Clean and purify the ordinary bones, so you may play with the immortals. In an early sutra, when the Buddha talks about his own path, he says, he's talked about before his awakening, when he was an unawakened bodhisattva, and himself being subject to old age and illness and death and sorrow, that he realized that he kept going towards those very things, old age, sickness, death, and sorrow, to try and find his freedom, to liberate himself. And he said, then what if I, being subject to all of these truths, rather than seeking my liberation from those very things that are causing me suffering, what if I were to seek the unborn, unexcelled rest from the yoke that binds? What if I were to seek that which is free of all aging, free of death, free of sorrow? What then? And so being stuck within our cycles of insecurity, of grasping, of longing, and seeking again and again to look for our happiness and stability within those things which are themselves insecure, which in themselves are suffering. The Buddha says, what if I seek a different path? What if I seek a path in which that is free, in which that which I'm seeking is itself free of that which I want to be free of? We speak of the path as being a path of non-attachment, of non-accumulation, that the nature of our clinging, karmically, is to continue, is to accumulate. The nature of desire is for more, right? I mean, our time on this planet Earth is a you know, robust testimony to the fact that if one is good, six is better, 600 is great, 6 million is best. That the nature of desire is really the image of the hungry ghost, is for more. And the Buddha said that we cling to sense pleasures, which are, in a sense, the easiest, because there's immediate gratification. There's pleasure, right? Who doesn't like pleasure? We experience it directly. It's not a decision. It's not a thought process. It's just an immediate experience. He said we also cling to views, our perspectives, our attitudes, our beliefs. we attach to rules and rituals, right? Which in every realm in which we create rules and rituals, we become attached. And of course, Buddhist practice has its own variety of rules and rituals. And that's what's so marvelous about Buddhist practice, is that those very instruments of training, right, which are upaya, are presented as upaya, and part of the upaya is to not attach to them. And then lastly is the sense of self. One of the deepest, most long-lasting, lingering attachments we have. So how do we be free of pleasures within a world where we experience pleasure? How do we be free of views in a world where we have views, and so on? And the Buddha realized that before taking a step, we have arrived at that place. It's our nature. That before letting go of a single thing, the burden that we experience is itself fundamentally non-binding. That's its nature. And that being so, then how do we discover this for ourselves? That's really what training is. And so in the pointer, he creates the image of riding an ox, which is represents the self-nature, looking for an ox. We're on the damn thing. We're looking for it. And so in practice, each of us comes in, we're given instruction, the essential instruction to the path, zazen, and we're shown to our seat. And since we've been given a map to a Master Dogen spoke of as this inner chamber, and in essence, we are now, it's up to us to find our way. To realize for ourselves that to be attached to things is illusion. And that while the path of non-attachment is long, because the path of attachment is long. That when we hear the Buddha's teaching on clinging to sensual pleasures and views and rules and rituals and self, that we hear that from that mind of attachment. Which means we can only hear a little bit of it. That when we hear the teaching on the first of the Four Noble Truths, that life is dukkha. Because our mind is, our basic perspective, our position is in dukkha. We can only hear a little bit, but that little bit's enough. It's interesting that given, in a sense, in our encounter with the Dharma, how in a sense slight that encounter is because of just where we're starting from, the depth of resonance or affinity or conviction or faith or there can be. And so we practice all the way through, letting go, not clinging. And we do that by not denying, by not avoiding, by not suppressing. And we do that by not grasping, by not indulging. And so he asks, how can we avoid the extremes? How do we realize the middle way? Well, the middle way is the essential nature of things. And so when we are not caught in the extremes, we will find the middle way. And that path has to be peaceful, fundamentally. And the peacefulness of that path sometimes takes a very ferocious appearance. But that in that ferocity, there has to be an essence of peacefulness. That within that fierceness, sometimes we have to encounter within ourselves, bring to our practice, because the karmic energy that we're facing has a fierceness of its own. that it's fierceness without aggression. It's fierceness without a desire to control or to subjugate or to dominate. You know, our capacity to acclimate and adjust and become accustomed to is so deep, so amazing, really, that becomes so much of what we struggle with. So that if, you know, for somebody who has, you know, found their way through life by driving themselves and pushing and challenging themselves, then it's like, if I'm not struggling, if I'm not in pain, if I'm not competing, then I'm not doing anything. I'm not practicing. Or another strategy, having another strategy to life might be, if I'm not numb, given the state of things, then something's wrong. Somebody sent me an article that was in Wired magazine. There was an article on people who, or just the phenomena of great wealth, of people having great wealth. And so they're interviewing people who have different degrees of wealth. And one person said, those with a few million dollars often see their accumulated wealth as puny, a reflection of their modest status within the new Gilded Age, when hundreds of thousands of people have accumulated such significantly larger fortunes. He says, if you're nobody with $10 million, then what does it cost to be somebody? So here he says, speaking from the place where he, and the article is basically saying, talking about all these people who have millions of dollars and who are kind of still in a sweatshop work environment, self-imposed, working 10, 12, 15 hours a day, driving themselves 6-7 days a week. One person said, here, the top 1% chases the top 1/10%. Top 1/10% chases the top 1/100th of 1%. He said, you try not to get caught up in it, but it's hard not to. Amen to that. So what does it cost to be somebody? And so each of us may need to sort of translate that into our own piece of real estate. Right? So what is that for us? What is that race? What is it going to cost to be somebody within the currency of our own lives? Whether it's wealth or status or position, career, possessions. But what the Buddha realized is still true and will always be true as long as we're basically human beings, which is that leads to disappointment. Which is why the ongoing pursuit. And so the Buddha says, what if I seek that which is free of those sense pleasures, of those views, of those rules and rituals within that particular framework, of that sense of self? What if I cease trying to build a somebody? Then what am I? Because our basic nature is free, practice is always bringing our attention to the moments where we're not. And to let go of that, to see and examine and let go of that which is binding us, we're creating a sense of being bound. So this Yan Yang says, when not a single thing is brought, then what? When I don't have a single thing to bring forward, when nothing remains, then what? When I'm in a state of complete non-production, non-attachment, not a thing at all, then what? And Zhao Zhou says, put it down. So we chant, all dharmas are forms of emptiness. But empty of what? So Buddha's teachings speak of the idea that things are not empty as perceiving them as existing on their own side, from their own side. They exist intrinsically by themselves. So that when the Buddha realized emptiness to being the nature of the self, he realized that all things arise in a state of mutual dependence. There is nothing that arises on its own. Everything arises together, codependently. And if we really examine that and examine the implications of that in everything, when the Buddha said life is dukkha, he said all conditioned existence is dukkha, which is everything and anything that we can experience. So what are the implications? That everything arises in a state of mutuality, mutual dependence, not by itself. It's just another way of saying that the world exists in a state of complete mutual responsibility. And we look at that in terms of our climate emergency, of forms of oppression, of our own state of being. It doesn't exist by itself. It cannot be, it's the suffering of that cannot be alleviated by itself. It cannot be liberated by itself. The idea by itself is itself the delusion. So when Yan Yang says, "What when not a single thing is brought, then what?" Why is he asking that question? If there is not a single thing, why is he asking the question? What is still binding him that would cause him to ask that question? Master Yunmen, in another koan, talked about the very subtle forms of attachment that arise through the course of practice. He said, when one has penetrated the emptiness of all things, then subtly it seems like there is still something, because our clinging to Dharma is not yet forgotten. Our sense of self still remains, and we remain in the realm of this karmic body. And to the degree that something still remains as something, that something is still creating a sense of bondage. And so Zhao Zhou says, put it down. The footnote to that says, robe and shirt sticking to the body, understand you should shed them. Yes, this too. And to have faith, to have conviction in non-attachment, in not attaching, in not accumulating, in not possessing. When we have so much faith that that's how we succeed. That's how we will succeed. That's how we're going to get happy. That's how we're going to be fulfilled. And so I was thinking of the 10 values that we create in the, through the Beyond Fear of Differences work, and how each of those, which was specifically came out of our work on anti-racism and anti-oppression, are so important, because in that it's the same stuff. It's the same practice, it's the same principle, it's the same barriers in a certain sense, it's the same liberation as liberating self. And so there's trust. We have to trust that we are working together towards mutual well-being, because there's no other kind. Being codependent means we mutually arise within our suffering, and we can only be liberated together. That equity, that what we practice, what we do, should result in just outcomes, as it's phrased here, in equality. At the deepest level, that being our fundamental nature, but also at every level. I was listening to a speech of Martin Luther King, because we're going to have a Martin Luther King day next Sunday during the morning. And he asked the question, what kind of society is it that creates, that by its correct functioning, creates homelessness and poverty and injustice? That those are not aberrations of that system. That's what the system is designed to produce. And so we need courage, the ability to step forward. We will be uncomfortable more than we think. We have to be accountable. We have to hold ourselves accountable. In a sense, when people are coming into training for residency as students, we don't necessarily frame it that way, but in a certain sense, that's what we're asking. Are you at a point where you can take a basic, be basically accountable to yourself, to your thoughts, your words, your actions, the effect of your actions on others? Can you be responsible to yourself? And then we have to do that for each other. We have to have humility. Oh, yeah. And really understand what that is. To cultivate reverence, which in a period of time in which we have, in a sense, desecrated. In a sense, that's become our Midas touch. We touch something, and it becomes desecrated. It becomes a thing. It becomes an object for our use. It becomes potential future trash. Reverence, generosity, to just be basically in a state of cultivating a generous spirit and heart. Whole person framework to see the self and others as a universe. And in every universe, there's heaven and hell and everything in between. Cultural fluency to know, in a sense, our own internal culture, to know the cultures of others. Sort of the foundations, the views, the rules and rituals upon which these atmospheres did we exist in, and that we create worlds within, be known, be seen, be studied. And then lastly, and so importantly, that we be authentic. It's just another way of speaking of honesty, to be authentic. The difficulty with attachment is that we do get rewarded all the time. All the time. You know, it's like as we study and realize, begin to realize the emptiness of the self in thought, in emotion, in physicality, in the body-mind complex. We realize that selflessness. We have direct experience of that selflessness. But then you bump your head and it hurts. And that sense of emptiness disappears and is replaced by solidity and me and it. And it's so real. And so we go back again. We return. We continue and experience that again until that sort of basic ground, that impulse, that reactivity, which is based in the sense of separateness, begins to truly come apart. It's hard not to get caught up in it. We try, but it's hard not to. And so Yan Yang says, well, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? When I've gotten to the point where there is not a single thing, Dogen says, put that down. And Yan Yang says, how can I put it down? And Zhao Zhou says, okay, very well. Carry it out with you then. That's what is happening all along the way. The choice is ours. The life is ours. The path is ours. The responsibility is ours. And that, the solitude of that, exists within a profound dynamic state of mutuality. In that article, it was talking about why it seems that the more wealthy people get, the more lacking in empathy, but the more cold-hearted. I mean, these are very broad, you know, assumptions or descriptions of individual people. But it was looking at that, and it said, what if, the author said, what if it's the compounded disappointment of both being lucky, right, of having such success, but feeling unfulfilled? I read an article years and years ago about a therapist who specialized in working with clients who had great wealth, particularly people who had come into wealth suddenly, like through, you know, the lotto. What do you call it?
Lottery.
Huh? Lottery. Lottery, right. and she said these clients would come to her because they had the, you know, they were so lucky and they were so unhappy. And nobody wanted to listen about to hear to them talk about it, right? Right? If you're so unhappy, give me some of your unhappiness, right? Which they didn't want to do either. He said, we're told that those with the most toys are winning, that money represents points on the scoreboard of life. But what if that tired story is just another facet of a scam in which everybody's getting ripped off? Is it any different from the scam of white supremacy or male dominance or religious righteousness or American exceptionalism? Aren't these all just different views that are intended to benefit some at the cost of others, but are actually ripping everybody off? Not equally, by any means. And so in the same way, we can replace money here with whatever is most dear to us, with whatever is in our mind that ticket to that thing that we need, that we must have. And when we come into practice, then that currency can be enlightenment. It can be our boundless compassion. It can be the depth of our loving kindness. It can be our non-attachment. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, the great lay adept Vimalakirti said, the Dharma is without any taint. It's free of defilement. Anyone who is attached to something, even to liberation, is in their actions, in their mind, not ultimately interested in the Dharma, but is interested in attachment. The Dharma is not an object. So if we're pursuing objects in those moments, we're not actually interested in the Dharma, but we're interested in objects. The Dharma is not a secure refuge. It's not a place. It's not a sort of cage of protection. So if we're seeking a secure refuge, we're not seeking the Dharma. He says, ultimately, if you're interested in the Dharma, you should take no interest in anything. What does he mean by that? Robert Thurman, who translated that translation of the Vimalakirti Sutra in the footnote, says, this is Vimalakirti's definition of the religion of Buddhism in its true sense. Selfish attachment to anything, even Dharma, Nirvana, liberation, is ultimately a selfish grasping. And this can very easily be misunderstood as a kind of nihilism, as a kind of absolute state of not caring, to not be interested in a single thing, right? Sounds like a kind of absolute isolation, an absolute turning away. And so we have to be very careful in our understanding that in detachment, we talk about detachment, which is really just spaciousness of mind, stability. That we might think of that as distant or aloof or cold, and we might actually aspire to that, that's how we're going to be liberated from suffering. Whereas really, those are just descriptions of samsara, of attachment itself. The article talked about how the tendency is when we get more money is we tend to use that to isolate ourselves from each other. We buy a car, we don't have to use public transportation, we move out of the apartment with noisy neighbors, we get our house on the hill, we stay in expensive places, we don't sleep on other people's couches. We use the money to insulate ourselves from the risk, the noise, the inconvenience. But it comes at the cost of isolation. And then he says, researchers have concluded again and again, over and over and over and over again, that the single most reliable predictor of happiness is being embedded within a community. The single most reliable predictor of well-being is being in community, in an active, tangible, living, mutual relation. Which from a Buddhist perspective, it's not even that it makes sense. It's like gravity. It's just the way things work. It might warm our hearts. It might sound nice. It makes for wonderful poetry and song, but it's just the way things are. Because that's our nature. Every part of our being exists in a ever-present state of mutuality. That's what the Buddha realized. That's what codependence means. That's what emptiness means. And so it can only be so that the more we isolate ourselves, the more we will feel unhappy, which is kind of interesting when you think about, you know, some of the great practitioners of Buddhism who have been hermits, solitary hermits. And so how were they in community? Because they were. And so in that way, it's showing us that it is both something that we must do in the physical presence of others, but it's also something more, right? Because that's how it is that we can be living in community and be isolated and be disconnected, be estranged. He talked about neuroscientists who have used MRI machines to show that selfless generosity is embedded in human nature. That it's not just a benevolent cultural overlay, he says, but it's evolved from the architecture of our brains. And I would say even deeper still, beyond our biology, that it is our fundamental nature. That's what Buddha nature is. That's why enlightenment and compassion are inseparable. And so when we have people of power, leaders, people in authority who are preaching, fomenting, creating, encouraging forsakenness, that we forsake others, that we disregard them, we deny them, we kill them. And we generate the necessary fear and the anger and the hatred and the greed to do that, to motivate that. And we create views and rules and rituals and senses of self, individual and collective. My whiteness, my country, my Christmas, my guns, my religion, my liberation. It's all really just the buying and selling of unhappiness, buying and selling of isolation. Zhao Zhou said, his two turning words, put it down and carry it out, that we have to pull out our tendons, extract our marrow, change our bones, and wash our guts, and then walk hand in hand with Xiaoxiao. What kind of putting down is that? He says, some say pure tranquility is the real basis of the path. The unconcerned are immortal. Even so, don't take unconcern for unconcern. Time and again, concern is born of unconcern. That when these teachers talk about unconcern, they're not talking about forsaking. They're talking about freeing ourselves of that which brings us to forsake, which means going to the heart of being free of all concerns, which can only happen when we realize that there is nothing to be put down. There is nothing to be picked up. There is no one to become. Then, the great concern of Kanon Bodhisattva is liberated. And so we practice letting go and letting go and letting go still more. And when we have let go of every single thing, then we let go of that. Of the very idea of letting go, of the very need to let go. And none of this we're going to figure out, right? We're not just going to decide, okay, I'm just going to do that. Okay, I've done that. It's a path. When Dogen says, forget the self, it's to forget that you've forgotten. And so training is to awaken us from that sleep of our unconcern, of the ways in which we forsake ourselves and others, so that we can realize true concern and arrive at that time over and over again in which genuine concern is born. You know, it's so easy to become entangled in what we love and hate. It's so easy to become numb in what we love and hate. And so that's why in the faith mind it says, when love and hate are both absent, or clear, or liberated, then the way is clear. And so in the poem, when he says, not prepared for meticulous action, he loses, he's talking about Yan Yang, loses to the first move. Realizing the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. Because he asks that question, he shows his mind, which is excellent. Right? He also shows his attachment. But how else can it be seen? How else can he see it? And in asking, then his teacher reflects that back, not by explaining it to him, but by bringing him directly to it. When the game is ended, the axe's handle is rotted at his side. That refers to an old Chinese story in which a woodsman was out in the woods cutting down trees for lumber. And he saw some people in the woods playing chess. And he stood next to them, leaning against his axe. And the next thing he knew, they were gone. It was a different season, and his axe handle had rotted. This is what the teacher meant when he said, pull out your tendons, extract your marrow, change your bones, and wash out your guts. When we forget time and place, position, somebody, then we return to this same very world, now free of all of those somebodies occupying each and everything. Clean and purify the ordinary bones so that you can play with the immortals, the deathless, the birthless. You know, it's probably just as well that when we enter into training, we can't understand how large it is, how vast it is. You know, if you're going out to climb a mountain and you stood at the base of the mountain and you couldn't see its top, would you still climb? But what happens when you climb a mountain? You see its top, and as you start climbing, you know, you see where it's all starting to level off, and you think, oh, I've arrived. And you get all excited and happy, and you pick up your pace, and confidence blossoms, and then you realize, oh, no, this isn't the top yet. And so then you keep walking, and that happens again, then happens again, until you just stop waiting to get to the top. So I'll end with a poem. Maps are handy, but they don't bring you closer. Words are so delicious, but already you're hungry. There is no real world to imprint on your banner that you carry forth, nor dream to discount each morning when you rise. Just hear the words of the ancient travelers calling you from deep within. Being called, listen. Listening, step forward. The one who deserves simple devotion is you. So vast, so boundless. Everyone is here.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.